Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'll be your happy host and tutor, Alex Linder, and everything I do can be found at vnnforum.com. That's where we keep our massive archive of educational material. Educational in the best sense, the stuff you need to know, put forward in the most lapidary terms we can come up with. Something that you will not find in any accredited official college. But as we like to say, it's a college where no one gets drunk and falls off a balcony. It's just a college where everybody comes away knowing a little bit more. In fact, a lot more, if you actually pay attention. Okay. Now, what we're doing now is reading The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds, which is a portrait, not a biography, but the author says it's most best described as a portrait of William Luther Pierce, who's a man descended from old Southern aristocracy and who determined fairly early in life that the purpose of life, or his life, was to use himself up in the service of the life force. And for him, that meant switching careers from being a physics professor who had gotten his PhD in just a few years after graduating high school to forming the National Alliance and serving the white race. And that is the work that attracted me to Pierce and the National Alliance, and which we carry on today with our Learning College. Today we're going to do Chapter 5 of Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. This will be about the same length the others have, about an hour, about 19, 20 pages. We're at page, I think, 61, and we're going to go up to about page 80 today. So we're making our way in a stately fashion through this excellent book. And I encourage anyone to buy anything that Professor Griffin has written. He's written two or three other books about living white, and also one sheath, one vine, something like that. I always get that wrong. I'm actually a chapter in that, and a number of other white activists are in there as well. Look them up. You'll see it. Anyway, Chapter 5, Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Adolf Hitler. That's what this chapter is about. A number of the books Pierce read during his Oregon State years, when he was a physicist out there at Oregon State, were about a man whose life and ideas were to give him both inspiration and direction, Adolf Hitler. How Pierce could have found anything at all to like in the most universally despised figure of our time, and probably of all time, begs explanation. This chapter will attempt to explain how it happened, says Pierce. One of the books I came across when I was at Oregon State University was called Hitler, A Study of Tyranny, by Alan Bullock. Pierce told me, and you've probably seen that, it's a pretty common, one of the more common books about Hitler, at least decades ago. Bullock was one of those court historian types. He'd write the kind of interpretations of history that would get him patted on the head and promoted and so on. So this was a very hostile biography of Hitler. But nevertheless, what Hitler had done in a very few years, and how remarkable it was, came through to me. In 1918, Hitler was in a military hospital, blinded from a British poison gas attack. He was just a corporal. He had no family, a limited education, no friends, no connections, no political status, nothing. He decides that he will lead Germany in redressing the grievous wrongs that had been done to it after the First World War and straightening out some of the mistakes that were being made in German society. And 15 years later, he is Chancellor of Germany, and he did what he said he was going to do. A wounded war veteran with nobody to help him, and he pulled it up just through his own willpower. That is an amazing story. I'm sure that Bullock would have been surprised to hear the effect his book was having. It certainly had a major influence on me. Not that I could manage to do anything of the magnitude of what Hitler did, but what a person can accomplish if he has a purpose and gives everything of himself to accomplishing it, that was what came through to me. I'm sure that if Hitler weren't so antithetically opposed to the Jewish spirit, which governs the world today, he would not be so demonized as he is. If he were not such a deadly threat, they wouldn't bother. Another book that made a big impression on me was a little book called The Young Hitler I Knew by August Kubizek. Kubizek was a close friend of Hitler's when they were both teenagers. They went to school together in Linz, Austria. Kubizek was a mild, mousy sort of guy. He and Hitler went to the opera all the time. They would get special student admission, which didn't entitle them to a seat, but rather to a standing position in front of the columns that supported the balcony. On a very cold night in 1906, Hitler would have been 17 years old, the two of them went to see a performance of Rienzi by Wagner. The opera is about a Roman tribune, Cola Rienzi, who is portrayed as a patriotic hero who wrests power from a corrupt oligarchy. Apparently, the experience had a profound impact on Hitler. Kubizek describes in his book how after the performance, Hitler seemed very intense. It was late at night and they walked together at the outskirts of town to a hill and stood under the stars. And then there was this outburst of emotion from Hitler. Words suddenly started pouring out of him, leading in a straining, hoarse voice about this feeling he had that his destiny was to lead the German people. Kubizek thought to himself, what the hell has gotten into this guy? Has he lost his mind? Kubizek and Hitler later went to Vienna together, Kubizek to study music at the conservatory there, and Hitler to go to art school, although it turned out they wouldn't admit him. Kubizek and Hitler drifted apart, and Kubizek went on to have a fairly respectable career as a concert musician, and of course Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany. In 1941 or thereabouts, Kubizek received an invitation to attend an annual performance of The Ring by Wagner. In the presence of Winifred Wagner, in her home, he met Hitler again after not having seen him for 30 years or so. Kubizek said to Hitler, "Do you remember that night in Linz when we climbed the Freienberg, the hill, after seeing Rienzi?" Hitler replied, "Yes, indeed I do. In that hour it began." "Why did that story stick with you?" I asked, says Griffin. "It really inspired me," said Pierce. "Seeing someone take his life so seriously and aspire to great things for his people, that stayed with me. And also, reading about this episode was one of the things that pushed Hitler to the center of my universe." Hitler, not extraordinary in any obvious visible way, not impressive in terms of being a great military man of heroic stature, but an average-sized man, nevertheless made himself remarkable almost by choice, by choosing to develop or let loose the will within him to achieve what he wanted, not for himself, but in service to his nation. And there are people listening to this broadcast who can do the same thing. I think there are a lot of people probably capable of what Hitler did, but maybe they never realize it. They never take themselves that seriously. We're all supposed to be eternally self-effacing and modest and lean not to thine own understanding, but what if there's another and better way? What if Hitler's life reveals that way? Just ponder that. That's what education is. It's thinking about things. It's reflecting on what you've read and what you've experienced. And it incorporates rational thought and also imagination. Because everything that is not necessary. It might have been different. And that's where you have to use your imagination, your artfulness, your capacity for putting yourself in the place of others, other men, other times, other positions, to see what might be. And to make it real with your will. And this all is what Hitler did. I found the section of the book by Kubizek about the time he and Hitler saw Rienzi together that Pierce had referred to. Kubizek tells of standing with the 18-year-old Hitler after the opera late at night beneath brilliant stars. This is a block quote from Kubizek. "Adolf stood in front of me, and now he gripped both of my hands and held them tight. He had never made such a gesture before. I felt from the grasp of his hands how deeply moved he was. His eyes were feverish with excitement. The words did not come smoothly from his mouth, as they usually did, but rather erupted, hoarse and raucous. From his voice I could tell even more how much this experience had shaken him. I cannot repeat every word that my friend uttered. I was struck by something strange which I had never noticed before, even when he talked to me in moments of the greatest excitement. It was as if another being spoke out of his body and moved him as much as it did me. It wasn't at all a case of a speaker being carried away by his own words. On the contrary, I felt as though he himself listened with astonishment and emotion to what burst forth from him with elementary force. I will not attempt to interpret this phenomenon, but it was a state of complete ecstasy and rapture, in which he transferred the character of Rienzi, without even mentioning him as a model or example, with visionary power to the plane of his own ambitions. But it was more than a cheap adaptation. Indeed, the impact of the opera was rather like a sheer external impulse which compelled him to speak. Like floodwaters breaking their dikes, his words burst forth from him. He conjured up in grandiose, inspiring pictures his own future and that of his people. End of the quote. And that's long before he goes off to war or anything like that happens. Kubizek then goes on to say, as Pierce remembers accurately, that 30 years later Hitler told him, quote, "In that hour it began," unquote. What came through to Pierce was the tremendous sense of mission that Hitler exemplified. One's life could be rooted in a grand purpose. One's own life could be taken that seriously. One could attribute that level of importance to his own existence. I think that Pierce took all that to heart, and that it has strongly affected how he sees himself and his own possibilities and what he has done with his life. By the way, the Wagner opera not only depicts Rienzi's rise, it also records his downfall, as at the close of the opera he is overthrown by a mob. Another book I read, Pierce told me, was by Dietrich Eckhart, and it was called Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin, and we did an audiobook of that, which you can find again at vnnforum.com. Although it was later when I read it in 1965, it did have a big effect on me. It was a short work, actually a booklet or a pamphlet. It was only available in German, but it was written in clear, simple prose, so I got out my German dictionary and I translated it. The booklet is an imagined or reconstructed dialogue between Eckhart and Hitler. The two were close friends, and Hitler considered Eckhart a mentor. Eckhart was 21 years older than Hitler. They undoubtedly had many conversations on the subject matter covered by the booklet. Eckhart's booklet helped me to get an understanding of the Jews. In particular, it opened my eyes to the message in the Old Testament. Biblical material tends to be misleading because of the high-flown poetic language in which it is written. I hadn't really absorbed the message in the Old Testament until I went back to it after reading the Eckhart book. It gave me a lot of insight into the Old Testament and the way Jews work. I had read the Bible through rose-colored glasses when I was a kid. I still quote some of the things I learned from the Eckhart book. Eckhart wrote Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin in 1923, just before he was imprisoned by the German government for his involvement with Hitler. He died as a consequence of his imprisonment. I published my translation of it in a magazine I had started called National Socialist World. I found the issue of National Socialist World that contained Pierce's translation of Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin. In the foreword to his translation, Pierce writes that Eckhart was born in 1868 in Bavaria. Pierce describes him as a, quote, "a poet, a playwright, a journalist, a scholar, and a philosopher, as well as a dedicated fighter for the National Socialist cause." Pierce writes that Eckhart was an intimate companion of Hitler. That may be true, but after reading this material, I came away with the impression that while Eckhart may have compiled the volume based on his talks with Hitler, he may have been trying to express Hitler's basic ideas, the way things are expressed in this work is more Eckhart than Hitler. The pamphlet was laden with footnotes and read like a scholarly article. In his foreword, Pierce said Eckhart aimed the pamphlet at the equivalent of a high school graduate. If that was Eckhart's intention, I think he missed the mark. I can't imagine the typical high school graduate, or college graduate for that matter, engaging the turgid prose of this volume. I've read it. It didn't seem that turgid to me. Also, the German level would be a little higher than the American level today. Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin amounts to the harshest of condemnations of the historical role of the Jews. Some examples. And he's got a number of bulleted points here. First bullet. With reference to the Old Testament, Hitler, or better, the Hitler character, is quoted as saying, quote, Really, the book of Joshua should suffice such a thing of suffice, such a thing of uninterrupted genocide, of bestial cruelty, of shameless rapacity, and cold-blooded cunning, hell incarnate, and everything in the name of Jehovah, in fact, according to his express wish. Second bullet. Hitler is quoted as saying that when translating the Bible from the Hebrew, Martin Luther translated a certain word as racial kinsman. But then, Hitler relates, the rabbi came and said that the word means neighbor. And so we have the neighbor, love thy neighbor as thyself, rather than, as it should be, love thy racial kinsman as thyself. Eckert, third bullet. Eckert says, no country, writes Sombart, Werner Sombart, displays more of a Jewish character than the United States. We have already seen a consequence of this in the First World War. In 1915, at a time when the true Americans hadn't the slightest thought of a war against us, and in fact were so disposed toward us that any indication of a possible conflict of interest could have been smoothly and amicably settled, a secret advisory committee met with President Wilson for the sole purpose of preparing the country for war against Germany. And who was the chief wire puller in these nefarious activities which were set into motion a full 2 years before the engagement of the United States in the war? The previously unknown Jew, Bernard Baruch. Bolshevism from Moses to Lenin was unfinished at the time of Eckert's death in 1923 and was published posthumously, drawing upon Eckert's notes. Pierce reports in his journal article that Eckert's last lines before his notes broke off were the following, quote, the realization of the unconditional dependence on his, the Jews, victims appears to me to be the main cause for his hatred. To be obliged to try to annihilate us with all his might, but at the same time to suspect that it must lead inevitably to his own ruin, therein it lies, if you will, the tragedy of Lucifer. I also read a book called The Lightning and the Sun by Savitri Devi, who had a very worshipful view of Hitler, Pierce told me. After Pierce mentioned that he had read The Lightning and the Sun, I made it a point to look into the book and its author. I found Devi to be a most interesting character. The Lightning and the Sun was published in Calcutta, India in 1958. Devi was born Maximiani Portas, P-O-R-T-A-S, in 1905 in Lyon, France. Her mother was English. Her father was of Greek and Italian background and a citizen of France. She took the Hindu name Savitri Devi when in 1932 she emigrated to India, which she considered the cradle of the Aryan race. Devi's many writings, published with the help of her Brahmin husband, synthesized Hindu thought and Nordic racial ideology. She idolized Adolf Hitler and gave both him and the ideology of National Socialism a mystique that elevated them beyond the narrow realities of German history to a kind of cult status. After World War II, Devi was arrested in Cologne, Germany, and imprisoned by the British occupational forces for Nazi propaganda activities. From the 1960s until her death in 1982, she was a leading figure in the internationalist neo-Nazi underground. Devi began The Lightning and the Sun in 1948 and finished it in 1956 while in prison. It is a long volume, it could have used some blue penciling, and in places dense and esoteric, with lengthy discourses on the elements of Hinduism she considered to be the legacy of the Aryan tradition. The book deals with a number of Devi's convictions, including vegetarianism and the protection of the natural environment, but it was her enthusiasm for National Socialism and adoration for Hitler, which most came through to Pierce. Devi used a man against time, in quotes, doctrine she formulated to portray Hitler as a mythic, godlike being. In Devi's thinking, men against time are earthly embodiments of the Hindu deity Vishnu. Vishnu is not conceived as a knowing, separate being in the way that the Judeo-Christian religions conceive of God. Rather, it is a force or aspect of all existence. Vishnu is the world sustainer, the tendency of every being to maintain itself and to procreate in its own likeness. It is the power that opposes disintegration and death. Men against time, says Devi, are, quote, saviors of the world, forces of life, directed against the downward current of seemingly irresistible change. They are forces of life tending to bring the world back to original, timeless perfection. These men against time combine the highest enlightenment and ideals, or the sun, with the often destructive power of a force of nature, lightning. Thus the title of the book, The Lightning and the Sun. In Devi's conceptualization, men against time tend to be martial heroes who, in the words of her biographer, Nicholas Goodrick Clark, G-O-O-D-R-I-C-K hyphen Clark, with an E in the end, men against time tend to be martial heroes who work to redeem the world from the thrall of the Dark Age. They combine wisdom with practicality, including ruthlessness and violence, to save and regenerate the world, and she uses Genghis Khan as one of her examples, as I recall from reading it. They are the real heroes of history, the men against time. Devi revered Hitler as the greatest man against time in all of recorded history. She viewed him as the champion of the old European tribal principles against degenerate cosmopolitanism, capitalism, and democracy. She admired in Hitler the very things others find abhorrent, his racist ideas and his anti-Semitism. She applauded the laws he propagated forbidding Aryans and Jews to marry, considering these laws instrumental in reviving the Aryan separatism she saw manifested in the Indian caste system. Goodrick Clark writes, blog quote here, his domestic modesty, vegetarianism, and abstention from alcohol she saw as the typical traits of the kindly ascetic. His ruthless use of military violence against his enemies in a resistant fallen world, no less his uncompromising plan to exterminate the Jews, an age-old adversary and counterimage of the heroic Aryans, identified him as the essential man against time. Devi describes Hitler as the true friend of the people, the true friend of his people, and in, quote, inspired by the inner vision of a healthy, beautiful, and peaceful world, a real earthly paradise reflecting cosmic perfection. And then there was Hitler's own book, Mein Kampf. When I was at Oregon State, Pierce told me, I read Mein Kampf for a second time. I had read it the first time as an undergraduate, but it didn't really turn on the light at that time. It did when I read it again at Oregon State, though. This man, Hitler, understood things pretty much the same way I did, and he was a gifted man in the way he went about things in politics. Although I knew I couldn't do what he did, I don't relate well to other people and I'm not a speaker, I was still left with a question of exactly what it was that I could do with my life. Adolf Hitler was born on April 20th, 1889, in a town in Upper Austria by the name of Braunau am Inn. Am is a contraction meaning on, the, like Shakespeare on Avon. It's equivalent to the Avon, a river. And so Stratford-on-Avon, where Shakespeare was born, was equivalent to Braunau am Inn, on the Inn River, where Hitler was born, you see. He was arrested for an unsuccessful putsch, a political insurrection, in November of 1923. Hitler dictated Mein Kampf, or my struggle, my war, my fight, while he was in prison. He was in his mid-30s at that time. Mein Kampf was published in two volumes in 1925 and 1926. The book gives Hitler's own account of his life, outlines the ideology of National Socialism, and relates the history of the Nazi Party and its plans for the future. A couple of years before Hitler became Chancellor of Germany in 1933, Mein Kampf became a bestseller, which is not to say that all that many Germans actually read the book. I found a copy of Mein Kampf. I had not read it previously, and went through it. It is a formidable tome, two volumes totaling 688 pages in pedestrian prose. Most would find it offensive and ludicrous. I'm not going to review the merits of the book's ideas here. Many others have done that. What I will try to do in these pages is point out what Pierce saw in it. I'll try to look at Mein Kampf from his perspective. I hope doing this will help explain what Pierce and others find appealing in Hitler's pronouncements. To begin, Pierce undoubtedly saw parallels between Hitler's description of German society during the 1920s and American society at the time he read the book. Hitler wrote of the quote, pitifully poor human beings, unquote, in Germany. He considered the Germans of his day too often cowardly in the face of responsibility, half-hearted toward the things that truly mattered, and lacking in spirit. Hitler believed that economic values and preoccupations were eroding his people. Quote, in proportion as economic life grew to be the dominant mistress of the state, money became the god whom all had to serve and to whom each man had to bow down. A truly malignant degeneration set in. What made it most malignant was that it began at a time when the nation, in a presumably menacing and critical hour, needed the highest heroic attitude. In Mein Kampf, Hitler decried, quote, big city civilization, as he called it. Rather than enriching and enhancing centers of culture, cities, he said, had descended to the level of mere human settlements, masses of apartments and tenements in which people lived cut off from one another. Cities had become little more than places to shop and to do business. People were moving here and there, and this was diminishing the bonds among them. Hitler also mourned what he considered to be the cultural decay in Germany. He wrote of the morass of the present-day environment. He pointed out what he considered to be artistic degeneration. Schiller, Goethe, or Goethe, and Shakespeare had given way to the base products of the time. Cultural forms of the past were being wiped away. Quote, every new institution, Hitler declared, the more wretched and miserable it is, will try all the harder to extinguish the last traces of the past time. Only those who can give nothing valuable to the world, but try to act as if they were going to give it God knows what, will hate everything that was previously given, and would best like to negate, or even to destroy it. Hitler said what was being pushed on the German people, so-called modern art being a prime example, was alien to their spirit, and beneath their greatness. He called for a cultural cleansing. The challenge, he argued, was to affirm cultural forms that reflect the truest and finest characteristics of the people. Griffin says, I'm sure that Pierce related to the negative picture of society Hitler painted in Mein Kampf. Hitler had put words to what Pierce was seeing in America in the 1950s and 60s. Thus, there was an essential agreement that Pierce had with Hitler's perception of society, and he resonated with Hitler's feeling of repulsion in light of what was going on. And beyond this general concordance with Hitler's overall point of view, what are the specific topics and ideas in Mein Kampf that hit home with Pierce? I believe they are the ones that I outline below. First, there is Hitler's biocentric worldview. Hitler's perspective on life was referenced in Nature. Hitler contended in Mein Kampf that before anything else, we must attend to nature, the world of living things and their environments. Man, Hitler underscored, is not separate from or above nature, but rather a part of nature. We need to come to grips with how nature actually operates. We must align our lives with nature. We must obey nature's laws. That is how we will best prosper and fulfill our destiny as beings. We should not be so presumptuous as to imagine that we can ignore or overcome nature's realities and nature's imperatives. We need to learn to live nature's way. Hitler's basic message was, get out of your head. Get out of the realm of fanciful intellectualization. Get out of what you think is true or ought to be true. Instead, quite literally, come down to earth. Within this biocentric frame of reference, Hitler focused on what he considered the fundamental human reality, the life and death struggle for survival, and a higher quality of existence among the races of man. As Hitler saw it, aggression and violence are inherent in this struggle. They are an integral part of nature's way. To Hitler, at the most fundamental level, human thought and action have an impact on the outcome of this racial struggle. He believed that what is responsible and right in human affairs is that which contributes to the continued existence and upward development of one's race. And as I always love to say, remember, 99.9% of the species that ever existed on planet Earth are today extinct. So what Hitler is saying is correct. According to Hitler, this is what it means to live by nature's rules and by nature's morality. Of course, anyone can put words in nature's mouth. Because, in a strict sense, how can there be anything that isn't natural? Whether it's cowardly to run away from a fight or heroically to run toward a fight, both of those happen. Both of those are genuine responses. Both of them are natural. So Again, it's as easy to speak for nature as it is to speak for God. Although nature has actual evidence you can draw from, so maybe it's a tad less easy, but still, there are many different interpretations possible. Hitler held to a biological slash cultural concept of race. As he viewed it, race has to do with biology, physiology, blood. There is that. But that is only a part of it. Race also has to do with culture, values and morals, philosophies, traditions, modes of artistic expression, religious orientations, ways of working, forms of government, national and ethnic identifications, family arrangements, conceptions of masculinity and femininity, approaches to raising children, and connections to the earth. For Hitler, race is about more than genetics. He used the term folk, or Volk with a V, which is pronounced as an F in German, to get at the idea that he was referring to a people who share a biological inheritance and a way of being. They have an approach to life in common as well as a gene pool. Hitler's concept of race was a dynamic one in that he emphasized the interplay between the two aspects of biology and culture. Each of the two affects the other. Biological realities or impulses shape the culture of a people, and concurrently, the culture of a people has an impact on their biological or physical nature. Biological urgings, call them instincts, predispose people to conduct their lives in a particular manner, wrote Hitler in Mein Kampf. This is not to say that individuals and races can't choose to act in a fashion contrary to these urgings, or that they can't be distracted from them by external forces in their world, ideas, people, and situations. It is rather to assert the existence of a more fundamental, more powerful force than choice and social conditioning. There is a calling from deep within human beings, a genetically rooted predilection to be a certain way, to proceed in a certain direction, and that calling, Hitler contends, wins out in the end. In terms of race, what this comes down to is Hitler's belief that the differences among the races go beyond skin color, and his conviction that you have to go beyond an analysis of circumstance and culture to explain the conduct and accomplishments of the various races. You have to take into account what Hitler holds as the most powerful influence of all on what human beings are like, biological inheritance. When Hitler dealt with the ways culture affects biology, he focused on culture's impact on breeding patterns, ideas, values, associational patterns, and so forth have an impact on who has children, with whom, within a particular race, and thereby affect the physical makeup of the race. Most importantly, cultural factors influence how frequently members of a race mate with members of other races. Hitler believed that racial interbreeding profoundly affects the biological composition of a race. Related to all of this is the aristocratic principle. The aristocratic principle can be contrasted with its opposite, the egalitarian principle. Simply put, the aristocratic principle says that some people are inherently better than other people. There are qualitative differences among human beings. Hitler contended that to view a man as simply a man is to be ignorant of racial laws. He posited that rather than races and individuals being equal, they are hierarchically ordered. Hitler wrote of the, quote, basic aristocratic idea of nature, which sees not only the different value of races, but also the different value of individuals. These differing values must realistically be taken into account when ordering the affairs of collective life, argued Hitler, whether it be political or economic arrangements, education, individual and group relationships, or anything else. So Hitler sees is both an individualist and a collectivist, which I fancy is not that different from what I have proposed myself. He was not a totalitarian to be lumped in with a communist, as he normally is by the Jews who are producing history in the U.S. and the West. Hitler said that while some may be attracted to the idea that individuals and races are or could be equal to one another, the fact of the matter is they are not equal now and won't be equal in the future unless the superior ones are hobbled in some way so as to bring them back to the level of their inferiors. Hitler's assumptions about race lead him to warn of the dangers of miscegenation. Hitler's big concern was interracial procreation, or another word for it, race mixing. Another word again is mongrelization. According to Hitler, race mixing compromises the superior of the two races being intermingled. It lowers the better race physically and intellectually and spiritually. Nature has no love of bastards, is the way he inelegantly put it. Those of mixed racial background are reduced in cultural and spiritual strength, he claimed. They have less power and determination than those of pure stock. Hitler saw racial crossing as running counter to what he held to be a grand plan for mankind to elevate its quality. Nature doesn't want the blending of higher and lower races, since the work of higher breeding will be ruined, he wrote. Any crossing of two beings, not at the same level, Hitler contended, produces a medium between the level of the two parents. Such mating is contrary to the will of nature for a higher breeding of all life. Now, that begs the question, though, well, then, why are they able to interbreed at all? See, he's speaking for nature, but not that plausibly, in my view. This is the problem with people generally who speak for nature. It's the same as God. Anyone can claim. If nature is so against crossbreeding, then why does it allow it at all? Later on in Mein Kampf, he noted that a racial porridge will prevent the achievement of the highest goal of mankind, a goal inherent in nature, the evolution of man into a higher form of being. Now, what's where he's on strong ground is when he says if you interbreed a higher IQ race with a lower IQ race, the average IQ of the higher race is going to drop. One hears much talk about the notion of Aryans as the master race. A consideration of this notion hinges on what is meant by the term master. Master can refer to mastery over other people, that is to say, the domination and control of others. So we're back in the same area as will, equivalent to will to power. In Nietzsche, it basically means will to power over oneself. Master race means the race that has mastered itself. The master of a merchant ship is one who is in control of the people and cargo on that board that ship. However, the term master can have another meaning as well. It can refer to the best, to the ones who have attained mastery at what they do. For instance, master carpenters or electricians don't rule over other tradesmen. Rather, they are the best, the finest in their field, the most knowledgeable and skillful. So there is a question of whether master race, in this instance, refers to the domination of one race over other races, or to those who are the best by some standard. Intelligence, character, creative output, having attained the greatest mastery over themselves, or self-mastery, whatever the criteria. I couldn't find an instance in Mein Kampf where Hitler uses the term master race. But it did seem to me that he uses the idea of master with regard to race in both of the meanings I listed, i.e. with reference to those who are the best by some standard, and with reference to dominance over others. In fact, he blends these two ideas. Aryans are the best, and therefore should assert dominance over others. By best, he means that Aryans have the strongest genetic and cultural features in nature, and nature's rules should prevail, according to his way of thinking. The strongest should dominate. He wrote, National Socialism by no means believes in an equality of the races and feels itself obligated to promote the victory of the better and stronger and demand the subordination of the inferior and weaker. That still leaves the question of what form the dominance is to take. Does dominance mean telling the dominated race or races what to do in every aspect of life? Or does it mean dominance in a narrower sense, of the dominant or master race being able to take everything necessary, every resource from the subjugated races, in order that the master race can move ahead in its evolutionary path as fast and as far as possible? My reading of Mein Kampf is that Hitler's focus is on domination in this latter sense, that is, having access to everything anybody else has said that you need in order to forge ahead. Said Hitler, "We all sense that in the distant future, humanity must be faced by problems which only the highest race become master people and supported by the means and possibilities of an entire globe will be equipped to overcome." And then elsewhere. And so the folkish philosophy of life corresponds to the innermost will of nature, since it restores that free play of forces until at last the best of humanity, having achieved possession of the earth, will have a free path of activity. That sounds to me, says Griffin, like an access to anything you need form of domination. Hitler believed everything to be at stake in Aryans assuming their rightful place in the scheme of things. He wrote hyperbolically, quote, "The man who misjudges and disregards the racial laws thwarts the triumphal march of the best race, and hence also the precondition for all human progress, and remains, in consequence, burdened with all the sensibility of man in the animal realm of helpless misery." And later on in Mein Kampf, he melodramatically added, quote, "Human culture and civilization on this continent are inseparably bound up with the presence of the Aryan. If he dies out or declines, the dark veils of an age without culture will again descend on the globe." Moving on to page 72. In Mein Kampf, Hitler expresses worries about the fate of the Aryan race. "It is particularly important that the Aryan race not intermix with other races," said Hitler, "because it embodies mankind's highest possibility. The danger the Aryan race faces," wrote Hitler, "is that it will be replaced by a new nationality, one seriously reduced in spiritual and cultural stature. The stronger must dominate, not blend with the weaker, thus sacrificing his own greatness," Hitler insisted. And elsewhere in Mein Kampf, "in a bastardized and niggerized world, all the concepts of the humanly beautiful and sublime, as well as all ideas of an idealized future of our humanity, would be lost forever. In every mingling of Aryan blood with that of the lower peoples, the result was the end to the cultured peoples," Hitler claimed. He used the experience of North America in an attempt to illustrate his point. "North America," he declared, "whose population consists in by far the largest part of Germanic elements, who mixed but little with the lower colored peoples, shows a different humanity and culture from Central and South America, where the predominantly Latin immigrants often mixed with the Aborigines on a large scale. By this one example, we can clearly and distinctly recognize the effect of racial mixture." When assessing the states of mind and motivations of individuals, Hitler employed the basic distinction between idealism and egoism. Idealism is being oriented towards serving one's people, one's race. I'll repeat that. Idealism is being oriented towards serving one's people, one's race. Egoism looks at things from the perspective of narrowly conceived self-interest and without a sense of connection to one's community, of kindred people and commitment to their welfare. Idealism is clearly favored over egoism in Hitler's mind. Someone who is an idealist is far more laudable than one who is an egotist, or, another term, individualist. Hitler wrote, extended block quote here, "This state of mind, which subordinates the interest of the ego to the conservation of the community, is really the first premise for every truly human culture. From it alone can arise all the great works of mankind, which bring forth the founder little reward, but the richest blessings to posterity. Yes, from it alone can we understand how so many are able to bear up faithfully under a scanty life which imposes on them nothing but poverty and frugality, but gives the community the foundations of its existence. Every worker, every peasant, every inventor, official, etc., who works without ever being able to achieve any happiness or prosperity for himself, is a representative of this lofty idea." Hitler asserted that race needs to be at the center of individual and collective concerns, and that the first priority must be given to keeping the race pure. "There is only one holiest human right," he declared, "and this right is at the same time the holiest obligation, to see to it that the blood is preserved pure, and by preserving the best humanity, to create the possibility of a nobler development of these beings." Hitler warned, "All great cultures of the past perished only because the originally creative race died out from blood poisoning. The ultimate cause of such a decline was their forgetting that all culture depends on men and not conversely, hence that to preserve a certain culture, the man who creates it must be preserved. The culture comes from the blood, not the blood from the culture." Since Hitler saw life as a struggle, supporting the race will involve doing battle. Block quote. "What we must fight for is to safeguard the existence and reproduction of our race and our people." Here he seems to distinguish race and people when at other times he equates them. "The sustenance of our children and the purity of our blood, this preservation is bound up with a rigid law of necessity and the right to victory of the best and stronger in this world. Those who want to live, let them fight, and those who do not want to live fight in this world of eternal struggle do not deserve to live. Even if that were hard, that is how it is. Like every other social institution, the state is in service to the race. That is to say, the state is a means to the end of preserving and improving the race. The state supports the aristocratic idea of nature by promoting the victory of the noblest and strongest elements of the race and demanding the subordination of the inferior and weaker. The following excerpts from Mein Kampf give an indication of Hitler's view of the role of the state. Quote, and these are going to be a series of blog quotes. The state is a means to an end. Its end lies in the preservation and advancement of a community of physically and psychologically homogeneous creatures. The state is the vessel, and the race is its content. The state is the vessel, and the race is its content. The highest purpose of a focused state is concern for the preservation of those original racial elements which bestow culture and create the beauty and dignity of a higher mankind. We, as Aryans, can conceive of the state only as the living organism of a nationality, which not only assures the preservation of this nationality, but by the development of its spiritual and ideal abilities, leads it to the highest freedom. A bad state is assuredly able to kill originally existing abilities by permitting or even promoting the destruction of the racial culture bearer. So imagine what he would say about the USA in 2015 and the way it promotes diversity, which is literally mixing the better people with the inferior. It promotes that. That tells you everything you need to know. The state, so far from being a vehicle for the preservation of the Aryan folk, is a vehicle dedicated to the destruction of the Aryan people. And that's why racial nationalism is the only cause that corresponds in seriousness to what is going on. It's no mere political partisan position. Hitler argued that the reins of the state must be in the hands of the finest individuals, those who are the wisest and the most efficacious. The political process must be designed so as to identify the very best people, given the aim of racial survival and progress, and then to bring them to office and dignity. That in quotes, office and dignity. Hitler is adamant that mass democracy is not the best way for this to occur. The finest should be in charge, not the masses, he declared. Rather than the rule of the democratic majority, Hitler affirmed the rule of personality, that is, the great man who takes control through what amounts to a process of natural selection. This is a quote now from Hitler extended. In world history, the man who really rises above the norm of the broad average usually announces himself personally. A philosophy of life which endeavors to reject the democratic mass idea and give this earth to the best people, that is, the highest humanity, must logically obey the aristocratic principle within this people and make sure that the leadership and the highest influence in this people fall into the best minds. Thus, it builds not upon the idea of the majority, but upon the idea of personality. Hitler asserted that in all other areas of life, other than politics, business, the military, and the rest, it is generally accepted that the best need to be in charge, and that it is not left to a vote to decide who that is. Hitler said many have a misplaced faith in the result of democratic elections. Quote, sooner will a camel pass through a needle's eye than a great man be discovered by an election. Another idea in Mein Kampf is that the family, with child raising at its core, is the central element of society. Everything else works around the family and serves to enhance its functioning. In the focus state, the state which centers itself around a shared biological and cultural heritage and destiny, marriage needs to be a consecrated institution. And children are, quote, the most precious treasure of the people, unquote. Marriage is not, in the first instance, a means of enhancing the happiness and well-being of those involved, but rather, as with the other institutions of society, a means of preserving and improving the race. Hitler called for control of breeding as a way to improve the quality of the race. The word for this process is eugenics. Another block quote here. It, the National Socialist state, must see to it that only the healthy beget children, that there is only one disgrace, despite one's own sickness and deficiencies, to bring children into the world, and one highest honor, to renounce doing so. And conversely, it must be considered reprehensible to withhold healthy children from the nation. Here the state must act as the guardian of a millennial future, in the face of which the wishes and selfishness of the individual must appear as nothing and submit. Those who are not physically and mentally healthy and worthy must not perpetuate their defects in the bodies of their children. In this, the National Socialist state must perform the most gigantic educational task, and someday this will seem to be a greater deed than the most victorious wars of our present mediocre era. In the National Socialist state, finally, the National Socialist philosophy of life must succeed in bringing about that nobler age in which men are no longer concerned with breeding dogs, horses, and cats, but in elevating man himself. An age in which one knowingly and silently renounces, the other joyfully sacrifices and gives. An age in which... Alright, I kind of misread that. But in elevating man himself, an age in which one knowingly and silently renounces, the other joyfully sacrifices and gives. Hitler also called for an education for nobility. Hitler criticized German schools for focusing too much on, quote, pure knowledge, unquote, and neglecting the development of personal character. He decried, quote, half education, unquote, as he called it, which he said pumps a certain amount of knowledge in young people, but at the same time removes from them nature and their instincts and their connection to anything beyond themselves. He claimed that students were emerging from the schools of that time knowing little or nothing of the joy of responsibility. He referred to students, quote, crammed full of knowledge and intellect, but bereft of any healthy instinct and devoid of all energy and boldness. He said the German educational system was turning out weak-willed people who lack forcefulness and decisiveness, rather than strong and courageous men and women, said Hitler. The schools were producing clever weaklings and cowardly physical degenerates. Hitler held up the Greek ideal of an education which promotes a noble soul, physical beauty, and a brilliant mind. He called for an emphasis on the development of firm character, especially self-confidence, willpower, and determination, and a sense of responsibility. And don't heap on material, Hitler implored. Help students gain the store of material that they will actually need as individuals that will benefit the community. This will necessarily include specialized training suited to the particular student. As is to be expected, Hitler emphasized the study of nature in order that students learn to understand and respect nature and live by its laws. A man must never fall into the lunacy of believing that he has really risen to be the lord and master of nature, which is so easily induced by the conceit of half education. He must understand the fundamental necessity of nature's rule and realize how much his existence is subjected to these laws of eternal fight and upward struggle. Hitler advocated a focus on the history of the Roman and Greek heritage in order that students find the motivation to contribute to its continued existence. Quote, especially in historical instruction, we must not be deterred from the study of antiquity. Roman history, correctly conceived, in extremely broad outlines, is and remains the best mentor, not only for today, but probably for all time. The Hellenic ideal, or Greek ideal, of culture should also remain preserved for us in its exemplary beauty. Not surprisingly, Hitler called for the development of racial consciousness. Education must, he said, quote, burn the racial sense and racial feeling into the instinct and intellect, the heart and the brain of the youth entrusted to it. No boy and no girl must leave school without having been led to an ultimate realization of the necessity and essence of blood purity. Thus the groundwork is created by preserving the racial foundations of our nation, and through them in turn securing the basis for its future cultural development. For all physical and all intellectual training would in the last analysis remain worthless if it did not benefit a being which is ready and determined on principle to preserve himself and his special nature. Hitler affirmed the value of a strong program of physical training to steel and harden young men's bodies. He argued for the inclusion of one sport in particular, one he acknowledged many people considered vulgar and undignified, boxing. Hitler says about boxing, "There is no sport that so much as this one promotes the spirit of attack, demands lightning decisions, and trains the body in steel dexterity. It is no more vulgar for two men to fight out a difference of opinion with their fists than with a piece of whetted iron." He is referring to the sport of fencing. "It is not less noble if a man who has been attacked defends himself against his assailant with his fists instead of running away and yelling for a policeman." Hitler saw boxing as teaching a young man to suffer blows and continue forward. Hitler's desire to avoid educating a, quote, colony of aesthetes applied to girls as well as boys. He valued vibrant health and a kind of steel spring physicality for both boys and girls. He wanted both boys and girls to be strong, agile, bold, courageous, and able to endure and triumph amid hardship. Therefore, he advocated a strong emphasis on physical training for girls as well as boys. At the same time, however, Hitler held that there were inherent and complementary differences between the sexes, and thus the ultimate purposes of boys' and girls' physical training were different. He distinguished between the manly strength to live powerfully in the world and to be a good father, and the womanly strength to bear and raise healthy and vital children and to be a good wife and create and maintain a good home. Hitler considered future motherhood, which he saw as equally important to education for careers or political life, to be the major goal of female education. And then, of course, there is the problem of the Jews. Hitler believed that the Jews represented the antithesis of everything he stood for. Jews stood in the way of all that he wanted to achieve. Jews were his enemy. What were his objections to the Jewish presence and influence in Germany at the time? According to Hitler, and more bullet points, Jews are alienated from nature. They seek to conquer nature rather than live in accordance with it. Hitler contended that the modern, pacifist, humane Jewish outlook is nonsense, quote unquote, given the true reality of the natural order. A second bullet point, Jews undermine the political system. Jews promote democracy, which excludes the personality and replaces it with the blind worship of numbers, ruled by the majority. The Jewish doctrine, this is a quote from Hitler, "The Jewish doctrine rejects the aristocratic principle of nature and replaces the eternal privilege of power and strength by the mass numbers and their dead weight. This denies the value of the personality in man, contests the significance of nationality and race, and thereby withdraws from humanity the premise of its existence and culture. As a foundation of the universe, this doctrine would bring about the end of any order intellectually conceivable to man, and as, in this greatest of all recognizable organisms, the result of an application of such a law could only be chaos, on Earth it could only be destruction for the inhabitants of this planet." Hitler cited the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 as a Jewish takeover of that country and the triumph of Jewish doctrine. Another bullet. Jews have gained a stranglehold on finance and commerce and control of key professions in Germany and have used this position to serve at their interest at the expense of the general welfare of the people. Next bullet. Jews have used their economic power to gain undue influence in the government in order to serve their own ambitions. The next one is the second to last. Jews are working to destroy the racial foundations of the European white race through the promotion of miscegenation. Definitely a parallel to today. They are doing this because of their basic resentful attitude and because it is in their interest not to have to deal with a sturdy white race, but rather a rickety herd. It is the Jews, Hitler wrote, who most wanted to bring the Negroes to the Rhineland with the secret aim of the racial mixing which was certain to occur. If they get their way, said Hitler, Jews will turn the European people into raceless bastards. And 100 years later, it's no denying that he was absolutely right. Final bullet point on the Jews. The Jews contribute to cultural decay. They are the spokesmen of a modern era, quote unquote, that debases the society. The Jews are equivalent to the chief modernists. Modernism being essentially the backwardness of all the existing cultural forms in whichever sphere, literature or painting, most notably. Jews contribute to cultural decay. They are the spokesman of a modern era that debases the society. They ridicule Christianity and represent traditional ethics and morality as outmoded, and this leaves Gentiles adrift. And he didn't say, but chiefly promoting sexual promiscuity and sexual bizarreness in all forms. In the political realm, Jews, quote, refuse the state the means for its self-preservation, destroy faith in the leadership, scoff at history and the past, and drop everything that is great into the gutter, close quote. The Jew, Hitler contended, quote, contaminates art, literature, and the theater, makes a mockery of national feeling, and overthrows all concepts of beauty and sublimity of the noble and the good, unquote. Said Hitler, quote, in everything base and profligate in mass entertainment and artistic trash, vice, or pornography, there will most certainly be a Jew. Close quote. And that's undeniable. Hitler's example and pronouncements appear to have had five major influences on Pierce. First, they encouraged the development of an ideological identity as a national socialist. Second, they pushed him towards a focus, race. Third, they helped establish who his adversary is, the Jews. Fourth, they legitimized his antagonism toward this adversary. This fourth one, legitimizing his antagonism toward Jews, is especially significant because in the post-World War II period, the idea of public or even private criticism of and opposition to Jews and Jewish interests has been considered by virtually everyone to be beyond the realm of acceptability. In our time, respectable individuals don't even think of assuming such a posture. And yet here was someone, Adolf Hitler, whom Pierce found to be extremely admirable, who had come to do just that, and to do it openly and proudly. In Mein Kampf, Hitler wrote about himself, I had ceased to be a weak-kneed cosmopolitan and became an anti-Semite. Close quote. If so truly remarkable a man as Hitler could be an anti-Semite, so too could William L. Pierce. And the fifth major influence on Pierce, Hitler's personal example showed him that you can take your life seriously and root it in a grand purpose related to the well-being of the race, and give everything that is in you to accomplishing it. That is what, at least in his own mind, Pierce has done. And that will bring to a close Chapter 5 on Adolf Hitler. Thanks for being with me today, and I will be back with you again real soon as we proceed with Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds by Professor Robert S. Griffin. I'll talk to you later.